We're doing Jewish history. It's a new semester, so we will reintroduce what we're discussing here. We are learning this wonderful work called Seder HaDorot, which is a compilation written about 400 years ago, which condenses many, many different works on Jewish history. And we had learned it from the beginning, from creation, right? We learned his recounting of Midrashim, and we went from creation all the way to the destruction of the first Beit HaMikdash. And we had learned about the Babylonian Empire, and then the Persian Mede Empire that overtook the Babylonian Empire. And now we're in the middle of studying the different Persian kings that took control of the Persian Mede Empire. Now, one of the challenges when we study this part of Jewish history, the Persian Mede Empire, is that in the Persian Mede Empire, you had many names for a king. So the word Koresh meant king, and the word Artaxasta meant king, and the word Ahasverosh meant king, and the word Darius meant king. So you have a recounting of kings, and sometimes there's a reference about Artaxasta and Koresh and Daryavesh, and they're talking about the same person. And it's very hard to know when you have descriptions of kings to know when the kingdom changed and when it's the same king, but we're using a different title. And this is one of the challenges as well when we study the Persian history books. We're not always sure when they're talking about different kings and when they're talking about the same king. It's a challenge when we study the books of Tanakh. In Haggai, Zechariah, and Malachi, they are the three prophets who accompanied us to the rebuilding of the second temple. They're the final three prophets. In Haggai and Zechariah, you have discussion of the kings, Artaxasta, and we're not sure who he is. In the book of Ezra, Nehemiah, Divrei Hayamim, Chronicles, we also have a discussion of these kings, and we're not sure who they are. A second challenge that we have in all of Tanakh is that when we have numbers in Tanakh, the Tanakh, the Bible, doesn't always tell us where you start the count. So for example, if it says that you're going to have 70 years to the Babylonian Empire, where do the 70 years begin? When you say 70 years to the destruction of Jerusalem, where do those 70 years begin? Jerusalem was overtaken 19 years before it was destroyed. Does the count start then? Does the count start with the destruction? You have two different prophecies about 70 years, and they're talking about two different things. When the Navi describes it was year 20 to Artaxasta, so we're not sure. Does it mean year 20 of the original Artaxasta, who was king when the Jews were first given license to go back and rebuild the second temple? Or does it mean the third or fourth Artaxasta, who was king after Ahasuerus, who gave the second license to the Jews to rebuild the temple? Because the way it went was the Persian Mede Empire overtook the Babylonian Empire. And then our first Persian king was Koresh. Koresh told the Jewish people, I honor the Jewish God, you're all invited to ascend and rebuild the Beit HaMikdash. Whoever wants to go is invited, we will back them financially, and I encourage all their neighbors and their communities to back them. They should go and rebuild the temple. Jews ascend to Israel. They come to Israel, they start rebuilding the temple, and they are met with the Samaritans, the Shomronim, the people who were imported to inhabit the land when the Jews were exiled, otherwise known as the Kutim. And they challenge them. They say, this is our land, we're the Jewish people, who are you? And they even fight them. And they see that they're not being successful. So they take Haman's son. We know Haman from the story of Esther. So he had a son in Israel who was a very powerful person. His name was Shimshi. And they write a letter back to Koresh and they say, you should just know, the Jews aren't just rebuilding a temple. Their intention is to set up an empire, take your empire away from you. They're a bunch of troublemakers. And if you let them rebuild this temple, you will only have trouble from it. And when Koresh gets this letter, he's convinced and he sends a message to the Jews in Israel, no more building the temple. So the Jews find themselves in a terrible situation. They gave up their homes in Babylon. They gave up their finances in Babylon. They moved their families to Israel under the promise of Koresh that they would rebuild Israel and rebuild the temple. And now they're being told, stop. And the Jews are stuck there. And 20 years will pass. Koresh will be king, and then he will die, and Darius will be king, Darius the Mede, and then he will die, and there'll be another king, possibly Ahasuerus, the story of Esther, and Ahasuerus is very adamant, no rebuilding the temple, and after 14 more years, meaning we hit a total of 20 years, Ahasuerus dies, and his son from Esther takes the throne, who is called Koresh, Ahasuerus, Artaxasta, Daryavesh. He has many different names. And we're not sure exactly how it happened because we have different stories as to how it happened. One story that's written in the book of Nehemiah is that Nehemiah gets word from a relative, from a messenger, Hanani, in Israel, who tells him the Jews are suffering there because they don't have proper walls, they don't have proper protection from their enemies in Israel, and they're being plundered, and he's coming to serve the king wine, and he had a special job. The king always wanted to make sure his wine wasn't poisoned, so Nehemiah's job was to always take a sip before he gave it to the king. In case it was poisoned, Nehemiah should drop dead. So Nehemiah was, I guess he was also suspect that he might be in cahoots to poison it. Remember, the previous king, Ahasuerus, had an attempt made on his life when they poisoned his wine. So Nehemiah's job, Nehemiah the Jew, the wise and pious Jew, his job is to bring the king his cup of wine and take a sip before the king sips from the wine. So Nehemiah comes to bring the king the wine, and the king looks at him and he says, something's wrong. You're not ill, and you look ill. So something's bothering you. And Nehemiah realizes that the king might blame him with poisoning the wine, because the king's a little bit paranoid about that. Now, the king has a dog on his lap. He has his mother Esther sitting next to him. And Nehemiah is very nervous, and he says to him, "Well, your Majesty, why wouldn't I be upset when the city I come from, where my parents are buried and my forefathers are buried, is all in ruins, and its gates are trampled, and my people are suffering?" So Koresh asks him, "How long do you want to go for?" So he gives him a time period, and he gives him, he says, go, you're the new governor, go, and I'm backing you, and I'm giving you money, and I'm giving you everything you need, go and rebuild it, and then come back. So Nehemiah sends to Israel. And the book of Nehemiah, which by Jewish tradition is swallowed in the book of Ezra, Jewish tradition does not separate the book of Ezra into two books, Ezra and Nehemiah, even though it's very logical to separate it, because in the middle of the book, Nehemiah starts talking and even recounts some of what Ezra said. But our tradition is that Ezra was punished, and he was not granted a book on his own. His book is swallowed into the book of Ezra. I'm sorry, Nehemiah was punished. In Jewish tradition, there's one book, Ezra. There aren't two books, Ezra and Nehemiah. Again, even though that division would have been logical, if you would have asked me, I would have said there are two books. That's not our tradition. Our tradition is that's one book, the book of Ezra. Nehemiah ascends to Israel, and under his guidance, we have the second ascent to Israel. Actually, not really the second, because Ezra's was the second. It's really the third ascent. You had the initial ascent from Koresh, you had another ascent by Ezra, and then you have another ascent by Nehemiah. And Nehemiah comes up, and he wields a lot of power, and together with Ezra, they rebuild the second Beit HaMikdash. The non-Jews sitting in Israel, they're not going to take this sitting down. They send a mission out to Persia, and they start demanding, how could you do this? Don't you realize it's a bad move? The Jews tried doing this 20 years ago, and the king said, I can't let them do this. So Koresh says, I'll look into it. And he has his servants research the archives. They dig up the old document that Koresh wrote saying, no rebuilding the temple. And over there it says, no rebuilding the temple until a king sees fit to rebuild it. So Koresh says, the new king, Darius Artaxerxes, or whatever you want to call him, he says, it says over here, that when he decreed to stop the building, he said, until a king sees fit to continue. Well, I see fit to continue. I'm not going against what he said. He left me that opening in his decree. And with that, he tells him, get away from here and stop bothering the Jews. Let them rebuild the second Beit HaMikdash. And that leads us into the rebuilding of the second Beit HaMikdash. The challenge in all of this is, it says, in year 20 of Artaxasta, they went to rebuild. Year 20 of which Artaxasta? The original one who stopped the building? This one? Well, this one is a young kid. Remember, Esther, the oldest he could be is 6-7 years old. He's the new king of Persia, because he's Esther's son from Ahasuerus. Esther marries Ahasuerus in the 7th year of his reign. Ahasuerus dies in the 14th year of his reign. And if we're going to say only 20 years passed since they stopped building the Beit HaMikdash, that means in the first year of this kid's reign, he gives license to rebuild the Beit HaMikdash. He's a 7-year-old kid, this King Koresh. Again, so that's one of the challenges as we're studying this period of history. We don't really know. Do the kings overlap or not? The Talmud tells us at one point in the beginning of Tractate Rosh Hashanah, the Talmud tells us, who Koresh, who Daryavesh, who Artachshasta? They're all one and the same. But then the commentaries ask, which Koresh are we talking? Which Artachshasta? Which Daryavesh? Meaning, what? We have so many of them. Which one was one? It still doesn't answer all the questions. Yes?
So where was Nehemiah
punished? Oh. Remind me, Be'ezrat Hashem, we'll get back to that. Okay?
I'm curious, but yeah. is this guy like a bad king or a good king so far?
He was good in the sense that he gave us license to rebuild the Beit HaMikdash. Okay. He was bad in the sense that he said, A, that the Jews have to make a level of wood under the levels of stone that they were building to fortify Jerusalem. His intention was, if the Jews rebel against me, then the whole wall is worthless. I'll know how to burn it down. So he made the Jews vulnerable, even as he gave them license. He was bad in the sense that he said, I'm funding the rebuilding of the Beit HaMikdash so that you'll all pray that I succeed. Meaning his intention was for his own benefit in that sense. And he was bad in the sense that it seems he slept with his dog. And he was bad in the sense that Noahides are also prohibited from doing that. I'm saying, and he was bad in the sense that he limited the funds that he gave to support the sacrifices and the rebuilding of the second Beit HaMikdash. He initially thought to give an open license, and in the end he gave a limited license. So the truth is, I gave four different reasons, which are four different opinions. The Talmud says in the end he was bad. And the Talmud gives all four reasons as different reasons. How do we know he turned bad? Because of this. And another opinion says because of that. So there are four different opinions. I said all of them as though they're all right. In the Talmud, there are four different opinions why we know he turned bad. But I guess he was also good because he gave us license. I mean, under him, we did rebuild the second Beit HaMikdash.
He said, like, leave the Jews alone, that sort of thing. So he just leave them.
In that sense, he was good. In that sense.
He said for political reasons.
I don't know.
Does it say that he liked the Jews anyhow or not?
I'm not aware of that.
He was Jewish.
It seems he was Jewish, right? Yes.
What was Esther given, like, a lot of problems for having a kid with a non-Jew?
What was she supposed to do? This is what she, you know, she had no choice. This was under duress. There was no alternative here. I don't think I'm unaware of Esther being given problems. On the contrary, the rabbis gave her a tremendous position in Judaism. We read her Megillah every year. We look up to her. We say Esther the Tzadekes, right? Blessed is Esther, we all say after the Megillah. So it's interesting. My Chavrusa pointed out to me this week that Esther says in the Megillah, "V'chasher avadti avadti." Just as I lost my father's house, I'm lost here. When Mordechai tells her, "You have to go and bring this marriage with Ahasuerus to fruition. You have to make it fruitful. You have to invest in it in order to save the Jewish people." So Esther says, "With this, I'm done. I'm never going to marry a Jewish boy after this. I'm finished." So my Chavrusa pointed out she was finished because her son, as Jewish as he was, as far as we know, he married a non-Jewish woman. That means her whole genealogy is done. Meaning she realized that she would not be able to pull out of this. She, being the pious woman that she was, realized that if I'm going and I'm going to have a kid with Ahasuerus, I'm going to invest in my marriage with him now in order to save the Jewish people. With that, I'm done. So the sages paid her back and they instituted Megillas Esther. You know, it doesn't seem like this was held against her. We look up to her as
like
the great savior.
First place, huh?
Why?
But she had a pretty good reason to marry the king.
She didn't have a choice, but until that time, she was playing it safe. Until she had to save the Jewish people, she kept her distance. It was only when Ahasuerus would initiate romance, so then she was docile, she played along and let him do whatever he wanted. At this point, Mordechai is saying, you have to initiate, you have to go to him. You have to initiate a relationship with him in order to save the Jewish people. And Esther says, okay, if you're telling me to make that move, I'm finished.
Yeah, so it was just kind of like it was a pretty legitimate reason.
Right. She didn't have a choice, right? Right.